Now, without further ado, we would like to invite our first speaker up, Professor Sharma, and he's the professor in the Department of Politics here at USF, and he's going to be talking about the social, political, and economic landscape from the days of Gamal Abdel Nasser and up until ex-President Mubarak. Please give him a hand.
Thank you very much. My deep congratulations to the students for organizing this. Can you people hear me? No? Oh. How about now? No? Okay. Can you hear me now? Okay. Well, when Noor asked me to speak about Egyptian history, the past, the question is, where do you begin? Because here you have a country that's a civilization, that's history dawns back to the very dawn of human civilization, the dawn of human existence. So I thought, well, we won't have enough time. So I decided to simply talk about a modern Egypt. When does modern Egypt begin? It begins with the famous son of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, when he led the revolutionary action against the monarchy and instituted a new regime in Egypt in 1952. It was an incredible time in not only in Egypt, but rest of the emerging countries, soon to be called the Third World. Nasser was charismatic. He was larger than life. He embodied Egypt. He embodied the spirit of liberation and everything that went with it. And of course, Nasser, very much like his contemporaries elsewhere, was a staunch champion of anti-colonialism and anti-imperialism. So he found a tremendous unity with the other leaders in the emerging world, from India to other parts of Africa. At home, Nasser, now the destiny of Egypt sort of firmly in the hands of the Egyptians, was determined to create a new Egypt. He was determined to create a new society, a society that was prosperous, that was free, that had sort of overcome the legacy and the stains of national humiliation under colonial rule. Nasser thought big. He thought of pan-Arabism, the Arabic nations, which he believed, and to some justification that were divided by colonial rule, the idea of pan-Arabism. So it was a moment of tremendous optimism. But nation building is never a smooth process. Nation building is difficult. And modern Egypt's history reflects the trials and tribulations of nation building. And I would say that the record has been modest gains, many missed promises, and perhaps at the end, a lot of disappointments. Nasser's legacy himself, the great Nasser's legacy, is a mixed one. On one hand, he is greatly admired and revered in not only in Egypt, but in the rest of the Arab world. But, of course, the humiliating defeat at the hands of the Israelis in 1967 was a shock. You know, it took away the sense of bravado and hubris that went with pan-Arabism. And it was quite a bitter sense for Egyptians, you know, a sense of wounded pride. Nasser was deeply disillusioned, and he never recovered from that. What else did he do? In the economic realm, one of the great things he did was he nationalized the Suez Canal. But the real goal of many leaders, that is to carry out economic development, which is both growth with redistribution, eluded him like many others. In the political realm, Nasser was a populist. He was a great nationalist, popular appeal. He could rile up an entire society. And he would use that at certain critical junctures in Egyptian history to entrench his power as through populism, deal with, away with dissent and opposition, and in the sense create a one-party system. But having said all of this, the moral contract that societies have with their leaders was not broken under Nasser. The moral contract remained, because at the end of the day, Nasser was no pharaoh. He was a son of Egypt. He was a noble son of the Nile. And the Egyptians, even in the hardest of days, never forsaked him. And that is the difference between somebody like Nasser and those who followed him. Now, the person who followed him was Anwar Sadat. In the brevity of time, I'm going to go through it very quickly. Siddharth ruled for 12 years, a mixed legacy. What he did was he forged peace with Israel. It was a difficult thing for him to do. Most of the Arab world saw that as an act of treason, an act of deceit. But that was his truck. That is what he did. And in the end, even though he was vindicated in the 1973 war, in the end, there was a sense of bitterness in Sadat because of the treasonous act he had done. He had made peace with Israel. And at the end, he was assassinated in 1981. When he was assassinated, Hosni Mubarak was standing right next to him. But fate is such a thing that it spared him. And Hosni Mubarak, the most unlikely of persons, became then the president of Egypt. Who is this man, Hosni Mubarak? You know, when you look back in political history, he began with a sort of a rather modest and an unassuming man. Well, Mubarak never had the flamboyance or the charm of his predecessors. He was not charismatic. He was rather awkward and inarticulate. And he was, in a sense, a quintessential bureaucrat, unimaginative, sort of, you know, a clerk in the hierarchy. And many thought that he would just be a caretaker. But he beat them all. He proved everybody wrong, and he ruled for 30 years. What was his administration like? Well, he was a good friend of the United States, and we really need to acknowledge that, pay tribute to that. He maintained a peace with Israel for all that it was worth. It was a cold peace, but it was a peace nevertheless. What the Israelis offered and will offer is a victor's peace. The Palestinians can take it or leave it, and the fact is that Mubarak understood the realities of life. But at the end of the day, Mubarak's legacy, I would say, was one of mediocrity and stagnation. It was a disappointment. Egypt, you know, used to be a trendsetter in the Arab world. It was the place of high culture, of music and literature. You know, then it became a very bleak and a drab place. You know, then you had the Emirates and you had the Dubais of the world with their materialism and their opulence that sort of put this place in the background. And the Egyptians resented that, and they resented it greatly. Mubarak was a pharaoh in the sense he was merciless with the opposition. He had no hesitation in concentrating power. And of course, I'm not going to go into the details of the emergency law, but he did use the emergency law to entrench power. He did many things. You know, he banned political parties. The elections were rigged. 1.7 million members of the state apparatus, police, paramilitary, who did the bidding of the ruler. But in my travels in Egypt, the sense I had is what the transgression of Mubarak that really offended the sensibilities of the Egyptians was the callous corruption. You know, the sycophants, the cronies, the insiders benefited from his regime while the rest of Egyptian society languished. Even his wife, Suzanne, you know, this sort of haughty, ambitious woman with this sort of bourgeois taste. And then you had his son, Gamal, who was to be the crown prince in waiting. For all the sense of propriety, it offended the Egyptians, you know, the audacity of this man, the sheer arrogance that somehow him and his son can rule Egypt. This is something that bothered them. In the sense he became the pharaoh, and unlike Sadat, and unlike to some extent Nasser, he broke the moral contract with his people. He had crossed the Rubicon. His days were numbered. That's the way I see it. Then, of course, you hear about the 80%, the 80 million people, 40% living on $2 a day. I know I used to work for the World Bank and the IMF, and I was part of the Middle East desk. And it was horrendous. You know, if it wasn't for American largesse and the remittances of the toils of Egyptians abroad, this country would have been in a terrible shape. And yet, at the same time, you see the high life of the elites, the a large urban underclass developing in Egypt. You have, at the same time, young and educated not finding jobs. But Egypt had one other dynamic, which is unique to the Arab world, that it has the youth bulge, a large youthful population, dispossessed and not finding opportunities. Sure, some of them probably wanted to seek their fortunes elsewhere, but it was a time bomb. One of the great questions that has been asked is that why did rebellion in the Arab world not happen earlier? And I have only one word to explain it. It is called Hama. Hama is this sort of nondescript, now forgotten place in Syria, where the regime of Assad murdered 20,000 people. What it did was Hamas served notice to the citizens of the Arab world that the regimes of this, the tyrannies of the Arab world, would show no mercy. They would kill with impunity and they would kill with violence. And it is this that prevented. And I think what the actions happened is that the fear of Hamas evaporated, and that's when we have the rebellion. But even having said this, you know, I must admit that at the end of the day, somebody like Hosni Mubarak, he was a dictator, but he was far more, he was a benign authoritarian. You know, benign means that there was a greater degree of restraint and order in what he did, unlike the murderous regimes of the likes of Saddam Hussein, you know, in Libya, Gaddafi, and all these mercenaries, predators, predator states. So what has happened? What triggered it? I mean, you all hear the stories about how it happened. You know, it began in Tunisia with this one humble, poor vegetable seller, you know, in this hard-scrabble little town in the dusty part of Tunisia. And one day, the regime comes, you know, the woman, the policewoman, takes away his cart, beats him up, and in utter humiliation, what he does, he basically pours gasoline over him and he burns himself. What it did was it served warrant to the conspirators and the states, because what this man was, his name was, if I remember right, was Mohammed Bouazizi. And the face page, a Facebook thing appeared that said, "We are all Mohammed Bouazizi." In a sense, it allowed the Arab states to look for deep down for introspection. And I think what they found was an affliction, a malaise that afflicted their societies. And then, of course, you know how this translated to Egypt. In the case of Egypt, when this man, Khalid Mohammed Said, was murdered by the police, and his face distortion, mutilated, appeared on Facebook. And then somebody said, "Well, today we are all Mohammed Said." What did he mean? It meant that Arab societies began to look deep inside them. The humiliation, the violence, the indulgence that their rulers wanted. They were angry, and they didn't like it, and hence they rebelled. So what do we do today? And my time is running out. So many things to say, but I'll end on this note. And that is to say, revolutions can be hijacked. The history of revolutions are that they can be hijacked, that they can be betrayed. So the sacrifices that the people made in Tahrir Square needs to be somehow be guarded against both the Islamicist, the Brotherhood, and anybody else there who believe in one man, one vote, one time. And it's very important for them to guard this. I think it shows that, in a way, President Bush, the former, was always right when he said that the desire for liberty is universal. This is what we see today. So, but that is not the time to go into all of that. I think today is the time to honor the sacrifice of these young men and women and the people of Egypt in Tahrir Square. And I think we can proudly say that on that fateful day when Hosni Mubarak was humiliated, the Pharaoh kicked out of his office, on that day we can all be proud to be Egyptians. So that's my take on it. Thank you.